Welcome back to The Weekly on WOBC Oberlin 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. I'm Jamie Yu, and I'm joined by Owen Anderson. We are the co-news directors for WOBC this academic year. We hope you are all doing well. For today's show, we are featuring Alexa Stevens, production editor and contributing writer, and Anissa Kurivitsa, one of the editors-in-chief of the Oberlin Review. We're looking forward to chatting with Alexa about her latest article on food insecurity in Oberlin and with Anissa on the One Oberlin initiative. Hi, Alexa. Thank you so much for joining us. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. My name is Alexa. Yeah, thank you for the introduction. I am a production editor with The Review, and this is my second year being a production editor. And I write for the news section. I'm a second year majoring in politics.
So the first question we wanted to ask Alexa was, why did you want to cover food insecurity in Oberlin right now?
Yeah, it's definitely a really key issue, especially due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And I think food insecurity and financial insecurity really go hand in hand. And as the COVID-19 pandemic has exacerbated a lot of inequalities, it's really important to feature some of the organizations that are really doing the work to mitigate some of the effects of food and financial insecurity. And I think Oberlin is really unique in that the town really does its best to come together and mitigate those effects for city residents. And I was really excited to speak to some of the people doing that work and some of the people who have been putting in the effort since long before the COVID-19 pandemic began, and to see how they're staying safe and keeping other people safe during this time.
Mm-hmm. In your article, you spoke with several organizations. What was it like talking to these different organizations in the community, and were you familiar with them?
Yeah, I'm definitely familiar with OCS. I think everyone who goes to Oberlin is pretty familiar with them because they have the drop-off bins over campus. You know, a lot of people go visit a lot of their centers. So I think that was the only one that I'd really spent some time getting to know the people there. But the other organizations, I found them through other organizations. So Tanya Boster recommended me to, I can't remember who, but she definitely said I should speak to OCS and a few others, and Oberlin Arts, that I should speak to the FAVA director. So I think it was a really interesting experience to see how all these organizations are connected and they form this network. And so it was really cool to see the process of how somebody who is looking for resources might find them, the way that I found people to speak to.
Mm-hmm. So organizations like OCS and FAVA and even the Bonner Center Services they seem to not be as well known or as talked about as much as other organizations on campus. And we want to know, like, why do you think that is?
Do you mean other organizations like community service organizations or like campus orgs, like clubs?
Like just campus orgs in general, because I feel like people don't really ever talk about like FAVA or OCS, at least from what I've heard.
Yeah. How do I answer? Okay, so I definitely think that a lot of organizations that really directly affect the city aren't talked as much about the organizations that more directly affect the college, because a lot of people don't realize that they're only here for 4 years, but the town is here forever, and it's has so much history, and it's so entwined with the college, and I think it's really important to get more engaged, and I think Oberlin does a really good job of pushing some of these organizations, and a lot of students really do a good job of getting involved. But I do think that could be more of a part of the campus experience for a lot of people. And I think that if at the end of your 4 years you don't know of OCS, then you probably should.
Mm-hmm.
How would students get involved in these volunteer programs, do you think?
Yeah, I know Oberlin Community Services, OCS, has student volunteer programs, and they're always looking for volunteers, except during the pandemic, of course, because they've cut down on volunteers. But I think post-pandemic, I hope there's a spike in interest. I know there are a lot of organizations in the community that are looking for just hands-on assistance from students, the more people that can help package food and donate food and garden is so much, so helpful to so many people. And I think, you know, students, they might feel like a little bit of an imposter syndrome, like, how can I help all these people? Like, how can I solve this huge problem? But really just being there and just doing simple tasks that are in your skill set is so easy and accessible.
And I suppose, like, within the process of writing this article, did the pitch come to you just about food insecurity? And if it did, then how did you decide to expand that and talk to other organizations in the community?
Yeah, so the pitch was kind of more about what the issue is, and a little bit about like the ways that people are solving it. But I think the angle that initially jumped out to me was, like, I know so many people are involved with OCS, and so many people want to help. So I was thinking, like, I guess, like, more the angle of how this problem is being solved and how the community is coming together in the way that, even though I'm not on campus and I haven't been on campus since the pandemic started, I knew that the community was really coming together, because I know Oberlin and I know they'll do anything that their residents need, and they'll come together in the way that only Oberlin could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So while you were talking to all these different organizations, was there anything from your interviews that didn't make it into the article that you'd like to share?
I don't think so. I just think the one thing I will say that was really great was the responsiveness from all the people I spoke to. They're so willing to help and do an interview with the review. You send an email from your Oberlin email address and they'll respond right away, for the most part. And I think that says a lot about the community and the way that Oberlin is perceived within it.
Mm-hmm. And I think you mentioned your interviews were mostly over, well, they were all over email?
Yeah. It was a pretty quick turnaround, so I wasn't able to schedule a call because of the long weekend that I wrote it over. So, yeah, I did an email interview, which you can really still get the sense of community through email, because people will talk about their organizations with so much pride, and they'll talk about the community with so much pride, and it's really great to read that and to communicate with somebody in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Kathy Burns, the director of OCS, gave a few statistics. I think some of them were in the article, but I feel like they're important to note. So, yeah, due to the pandemic, she estimates that 30% of people receiving services through OCS are new to receiving services since the pandemic started. And I think that's really important to note because it has exacerbated so many inequalities, and there's still that 70% who's continuing to receive services, but there's that 30% of people who now are saying that they just need a little bit more assistance. And I think, you know, that number would be higher if everybody affected by the pandemic who would benefit from services would have asked for them. But I know it's a difficult thing to ask for services. And she mentioned that a little bit. But when she also talked about some people who have received services and then came back with, like, improved financial conditions when they didn't need help anymore and gave a check to OCS to try to fund more of their efforts. And we're so grateful that OCS really gave them that assistance that they needed to get back to work and to get the food that they needed to keep their family healthy and safe.
Mm-hmm. So really, like, these people are really doing all these things kind of just out of the want and passion to serve their community. So, like, how did it feel though to, like, get in touch with these people who are working so hard to serve their community during such a difficult time?
Yeah, I'm so impressed with all of the people who are doing the work to help their community. You know, the nonprofit sector is difficult because it can be really disheartening to be surrounded by a lot of challenges, and you can't, you know, solve them 100% any of the time. And I think the way that you can solve it the best is by getting the whole community involved. And I think that's recognized a lot, especially in Oberlin. Yeah, and I can't really speak to any other places. You know, I'm from LA, so there's definitely a lot of community organization, but it's a little bit more spread out. So the way everyone comes together in Oberlin in a little bit of a smaller area is so inspiring and so productive. And I think OCS really recognizes that they have a lot of gratitude for the community members and other services as well. FAVA and the Bonner Center, and they talk about community engagement. And I think the way that I felt when I was listening to them was that I really want to get more involved with Oberlin when I come back, especially because I've spent this time away due to the pandemic. And I'm really excited to come back and do some gardening and package food for people. And I think that's going to be something I make more of a priority in the future.
Mm-hmm. That all sounds great. And you mentioned that you're currently remote. Have you been remote since March?
Yeah, I have.
Wow. So what was it like then to cover community news while remote? Like, did it make you feel more connected back to the Oberlin community, or was it eye-opening for you?
Yeah, a little bit of both. I think it's a little bit connecting and also separating in a way. You know, I was doing another article and the person didn't realize that I wasn't on campus. So he said, like, do you want to meet me in Tappan Square in like 5 minutes? And I was like, I can't do that. I'm in Los Angeles. So it was kind of, I don't know, a sad moment for me because I realized, you know, I can't do what I used to do, which was just, you know, walk over and see the event that I'm talking about or see the efforts that I'm talking about. But on the other hand, it's really nice to feel that connection in that way, because I'll be talking to people as if I'm a part of it, if that makes sense. And I'll hear about what's going on. And it's really nice to be a reporter in this time because I can really keep up with what's happening and keep up with the emotions that come with what's happening, which I wouldn't otherwise be able to know about.
But going off of that, how long have you written for the Review, Alexa?
Yeah, since August of my freshman year. As soon as the day I put in the enrollment deposit for Oberlin, I signed up. There's like a little form on their website to sign up to write for them. And I did that because I knew that I wanted to write for the Review. I wrote for my high school paper. I was the online editor, and I'd written for a few online publications and print newspapers as well during high school. So I knew I wanted to keep up with that.
Mm-hmm. And we were wondering if you could expand on your point and how different it feels to be reporting remotely, especially in comparison to how you used to report like on the field or even like do production in person with the rest of the Review staff.
Right. Yeah. So writing remotely is not something that's new to me. I'm a freelance journalist. I write for Teen Vogue and I used to write for Kids World and a bunch of other places remotely. And I think that's something that's really familiar to freelance journalists. You know, I've never met some of my editors, even when I could have met them in person, if that makes sense. It's interesting to be remote, I think, because you never have like an in-person relationship with somebody that you spend so much time communicating with. But it's not something that's new. But I think it's different with the Review because it's such, it's a place that I got to experience in person, at least for a little bit. I became a production editor like 2 months before I was sent home, so I didn't get to experience it for that long. But yeah, in-person production was so much fun. It had this energy of people who really care about grammar, to the point that we'd have a lot of fights over grammar. And it's so great because, I don't know, I've heard this said a bunch of times, but Oberlin is the place where it's really cool to be a nerd. And I think the Oberlin Review really, really proved that for me. And yeah, I love grammar. I mean, I love that it's cool to be a nerd about grammar through the Review. And I think there's a couple Zoom things still going on, but it's not going to be the same, you know, as it would be in person with that wall of quotes in the Wilder room. And I think I miss it for sure. But I also think that, yeah, again, like it's not something that's new to the journalism industry. And if anyone can adapt to remote work, I mean, it's journalists, like we've been experiencing that forever.
I think that's very well said, and I very, very sorely miss the Burton basement office. It was such a, I don't know, such an eclectic space. And
I was going to say Wilder, I meant Burton, my bad.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's in Wilder now, so I'm...
Oh, it is. Okay, that's interesting. Do you guys just rent out the space, or is it like a designated space that you... Because I think from what I've heard, it feels like everyone's just kind of gathering in the main room of Wilder on the first floor.
Yeah, I think that's the case. I'm actually not sure what the rental system is like. But I assume they would return to Burton at some point.
Mm-hmm.
In your article, you mentioned previous stimulus checks and like how that has affected the community organizations. Did you talk with them at all about like possible upcoming stimulus packages? And if so, like what did they have to say?
Yeah, no, I actually didn't. So the stimulus checks was a reference to a previous article, which was kind of the premise for this article. Actually, it was Drew Dansby wrote a piece about like the effect on the community after stimulus checks. And I believe there was like a delay in getting some of them out. So it really affected the community. And I think this was a follow-up piece about how the situation hasn't really changed since then. And that was almost a year ago or something. Several months ago, regardless of how long ago it was. And so I think that was really the idea behind this piece, was what's changed in terms of financial and food insecurity since the last stimulus check, and what's changed since people weren't able to get that money, and how have organizations adapted to this need that is persistent.
So I wanted to ask you more, Alexa, about how you're able to juggle being a production editor and a writer. So you started out as a staff writer and then later transitioned to production, and that was right around the time that we all had to go remote. So as a production editor, why do you continue to contribute articles?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've been writing, you know, since I was like 10. I did ghostwriting and writing under my name, and it's just something that I'm really familiar with and something that I've kind of developed a talent for. And I think it's a way that I really like to keep up with news and to keep up with the community. And I just really like doing interviews and getting to know different people. And I think that's something that's become especially important to me now that I'm remote, as we talked about, you know, like hearing about how people feel about what's happening. No matter what's happening. And I keep getting those pitch emails from the news editors. And if I'm interested in something, I'm going to claim it, because I just really enjoy getting to know different sides of campus and town that I wouldn't ordinarily get to know, and different people that I wouldn't get to know without journalism.
I think that's what a lot of people have told us as well, that they just love getting to meet people and learn things as they talk to them. So your previous work I've went through, I think it's like almost all exclusively news. Have you ever written for any other section?
Yeah, I've written one arts piece 2 weeks ago, I think, about the Winter Oberland. I actually didn't choose that one. It was assigned to me because it was like a shorter deadline. And it was really fun to write. I really enjoyed it. I didn't expect to like writing an arts piece that much, but I might try arts again, because I really liked hearing about that event that I wasn't able to see in person. And hearing people get so excited about an ice rink, that was really sweet and really fun to hear about.
Mm-hmm. So I guess more broadly, like how come or why do you like the news section?
Yeah, I'm a politics major, so I really, what I learn about in class, like in terms of theory and history, is really interesting to see practiced both on a local, national, like state and current scale. And I really like news and politics in Oberlin. particularly because I come from, you know, Los Angeles and originally Connecticut. So I came from the coast, and hearing about news in the Midwest is unique to me because, you know, the small town, like, news feeling of speaking to city council members and speaking to representatives talk about their towns is very different from the way that people in the city will talk about their towns. And it's really great to hear because there are a lot more hands-on politicians around here. And I won't just interview politicians, obviously, like, I'll talk to professors and students as well, depending on what the news story is about. But I really got into it because I wanted to get to know what the politics in the area was like. And I think I've been pretty successful in that. I've spoken to, you know, a bunch of city council members and local representatives as well. And yeah, I really enjoyed having those conversations. So that's kind of why I chose news, was to become familiar with that arena in this new surroundings. And I think, yeah, I think that's been really helpful to my understanding of what news and politics in Ohio and in the Midwest might look like. And it's been really helpful to get me acclimated to the Oberlin community.
Mm-hmm. So I know it might be limited slightly because of how pitches work, but do you have any goals, like, looking forward, and what else you might like to cover, or other kinds of local politics you might want to explore?
Yeah, I definitely want to keep exploring more of politicians and elections in the future. I think, you know, I'll probably get the chance to do that in, like, the 2022 cycle, but maybe not until then. I recently was the deputy press secretary for Shannon Freshour's congressional campaign. So to be able to cover something similar to that from the side of a reporter would be really interesting, because I communicated with reporters and gave them, you know, press releases in the 2020 election cycle. It would be really interesting to see that from the other side.
Mm-hmm. Well, congrats on that. That all sounds like amazing projects to work on.
Yeah, that sounds really fun. Before we end, Alexa, is there anything else you'd like to add, either about your article or journalism in general?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. From my perspective as a college journalist, I can't really, like, see the way that the journalism industry is changing because I'm freelance and I'm a college journalist, not really trying to make a living off of journalism. But I do think, like, what I was talking about, like, journalism being remote is a lot harder on some people than it is on me. So I can't really speak to that. And I know, like, a lot of people who make a living off of freelance are really struggling. So I don't want to misspeak when I was talking about that earlier. But yeah, I do think, like, this industry has been hit pretty hard by the pandemic and by the stay at home orders. So I just want to be careful on, like, what I said about remote work.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you. So, Alexa, thank you so much again for joining us and talking to us more about community organizations in Oberlin and what it was like to cover all of it. And it was really great to speak with you.
Great. Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And we hope to talk to you again soon.
And now we turn to our interview with Anissa Kurivica about the One Oberlin Plan. Anissa, thank you so much for joining us. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on the show. I really am excited to be here. My name is Anissa Kurivica, and I'm the editor-in-chief of the Oberlin Review newspaper.
Mm-hmm. And recently you wrote an article on One Oberlin that we'd like to chat with you about. So I guess to get started, why did you want to cover One Oberlin for this article, like, right now?
Yeah, so, you know, One Oberlin has been this plan that was sort of created 2 years ago after this really long, intensive review of kind of every aspect of the college that ultimately ended up in this report that had a series of recommendations about what the college should sort of change, both to sort of cut financially and make the college more financially sustainable, but also to add like new opportunities to what they're offering for students. So, you know, obviously this has been happening for like 2 years, 2 or 3 years. But COVID kind of halted some of the recommendations. So they were just starting the process of actually implementing these recommendations. And because of the craziness of COVID, because, you know, the college had to restructure the entire academic plan, because they had to worry about implementing all of these safety measures, like a lot of things got put on hold. So the reason we did this story now is because President Ambar just recently announced that the committee that is implementing these recommendations is reconvening. And so a lot more of the recommendations will start to be implemented now. And that's not to say that like everything was put on hold during COVID, like definitely a lot of things still got pushed through. An example of that would be, and I guess this kind of started before COVID, but one of the recommendations was to kind of save money on dining and custodial workers, because the report found that Oberlin pays hourly workers much higher than comparable institutions. So they were like, we would like to pay those people the same amount as other colleges, which meant paying them less. And that resulted in Oberlin like outsourcing dining to AVI Fresh and custodial to Scioto Services. So like that happened. And there's like been several things that have still happened, but like a lot of things got put on hold.
Mm-hmm. I imagine you're quite familiar with One Oberlin. Have you covered it in the past for the review?
Yeah. This is definitely something that I have been, it's been on my mind since my freshman year, really. And I think everyone who goes to Oberlin right now sort of has this in the back of their mind of like, oh, there's this structural deficit. And like, what does that mean for our college? And what does that mean, like, looking forward? And a lot of what I've seen from the current administration is, you know, really hoping to make our school this like very innovative place that I think it has been in the past. And they're hoping to like continue that now that higher education is kind of like in this weird flux, especially for like small private liberal arts schools like Oberlin. So it's definitely something that I've been aware of fully since I got on campus 3 years ago. And it's been interesting to see how it like is developing.
And since you've learned about the One Oberlin plan in your freshman year, what have you learned about it since? And do you see parts of the plan in a different light now?
Yeah, I think with the context of COVID is really interesting, because, you know, there was a lot of small liberal arts schools that were struggling pre-COVID, that, you know, education is getting more and more expensive. Pretty soon there's going to be a lot fewer sort of college age students applying to schools like Oberlin. There's like this, I think it might be in 2026, there's this idea that there's going to be this drop off in 18-year-olds who are applying to college for a variety of reasons. So everyone in higher ed is sort of scared about this. And I think what Oberlin wanted to do is take this very proactive approach. Of like, we already have this structural deficit, which is already bad. It might get worse because we're going to have to be even more competitive for students, like getting competitive as in getting students to apply and ultimately come to Oberlin. And so now that COVID has happened, every school is in a much worse place financially, including, I think, to some extent, Oberlin. So when you talk to like President Ambar or other administrators, other people on the One Oberlin committee, one of the things they say is like, yeah, this sucks that we have more of a deficit because of COVID, but because we were already thinking about our budget, we have a little bit more of a kind of like runway. We have a little bit more context to deal with this COVID deficit because we've already been thinking about our budget for the past 3 years. So I think the thing that has changed for me is like this sense of urgency. Like before it was like, oh, eventually we're going to accumulate like hundreds of millions of dollars in a deficit, and so we better deal with it now. And now it's like there's COVID, and they had to do this extraordinary withdrawal from the endowment, which was like something that the Board of Trustees had to approve of. And it's, the sense I get is not that it's like a dire situation or anything, but that, you know, things are a little bit more immediate. So I think that that is like how my perspective has changed. It's just like in the context of COVID more than anything.
Mm-hmm. And where did that 2026 number come from, by the way, that you mentioned?
The like admissions drop-off thing.
Yeah.
That's something that I've talked to the dean of admissions, Manuel Carballo, about. And also something that I've just read about in like higher ed. Like it's a conversation beyond Oberlin. I'm trying to remember what year it is exactly, if it is, I think it's 2026, but it's just like this general sense that soon there will be fewer students. And you can look that up on like the Inside Higher Ed publication is always doing stories about this admissions drop off. And it's not like necessarily an Oberlin specific thing, but definitely something I hear people kind of concerned about at Oberlin.
And more broadly, One Oberlin and the budget deficit is such a huge topic. So as you've just summarized here, so how did you narrow your focus in your interviews and also in the article?
Yeah. So for this article specifically, we were focusing on like, you know, what things sort of got put on hold because of COVID and what things didn't. And so like, what is going to happen moving forward? I definitely did have that problem of like, One Oberlin is like the series of like 7 or 8 or something amount of like recommendations, and they cover all aspects of the school. And it did, you know, it's every time we cover it, it's like, oh, this is a really like big thing to like make a comprehensive article about. But some of the things we focused on were, one of the recommendations was moving 100 students from the con to the college. So that's not like moving existing students, but just enrolling fewer students in the con and more students in the college. And that would be like sort of a longer term thing. It would be over the course of 4 years. They would just slowly enroll 25 students less in the con and 25 students more in the college. And then next year, same thing. And the reason for that is that in general, college students tend to pay higher tuition than con students because with the con, you're competing with, like Oberlin is competing with like places like Juilliard. And there's just so, there's a lot fewer students, like 18-year-olds who are masters at the violin than there are 18-year-olds who can get a 1300-1400 on the SAT. Like there's just so many more students who would be who would maybe apply to the college, whereas to get a con student to come here, if you're competing with a place like Juilliard or Berkeley or whatever else they have conservatories, you have to like give them a lot more like merit financial aid. So the idea of like moving, it feels kind of silly to talk about in some ways, but the idea of moving people, not moving, but having fewer students in the con and more students in the college would be ultimately net Oberlin higher tuition that they would get, I guess. My point about all of that was that this year, that didn't happen. They were supposed to start moving, like they were supposed to start enrolling 25 fewer students in the con and 25 more in the college. And because admissions was so uncertain for all colleges, because like if you're a high school senior and you're like, do I want to start college in a pandemic? Like that sounds really isolating. Maybe I'll just take a gap year. So all colleges, or I don't know about all, but most colleges had a really hard time with admissions. So this year, because admissions was so uncertain, they were like, we're not going to make any sort of like picking and choosing. We're just going to like enroll the people that we can enroll. And so I think that they didn't do this like moving enrollment around. They just enrolled like the normal balance. Because a lot of people did end up taking gap years, which means that the freshman class is a little smaller than it like ideally would be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's something I admittedly didn't follow too closely because I wasn't really following the trends of high school seniors, but I imagine it was like probably a really difficult decision all around for both students and for admissions offices, because it's like it's a lot to, everything's so unexpected and uncertain, and then it's a lot to juggle all at once.
Yeah, and Oberlin did a lot of stuff to try to make admissions like more accessible to high school seniors, even during the pandemic. Like when you think about it, like a big part of Oberlin admissions is the All Roads event, all roads lead to Oberlin. And that couldn't happen because that was like, you know, that's supposed to be in April, which is like at the beginning of the pandemic. So a lot of the people who are freshmen this year, like never visited Oberlin before they came. And so Oberlin had to do all of these things. Like they had these summer classes for people who were accepted to the college and hadn't necessarily chosen yet. They had a bunch of like virtual events, both like between different departments, but also like they had a virtual All Roads Lead to Oberlin. And I just know that like a lot of people in admissions were trying really hard, in admissions and in other departments, I think too, were trying really hard to like reach out and get people to want to come to Oberlin because there were fewer students who were probably going to enroll this year because of the pandemic, I think.
Mm-hmm. So you've obviously spoken to a lot of people about this subject. And for this most recent article, you interviewed President Ambar. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I love Ambar. I love talking to President Ambar. I think a lot of what we heard from her, like I've kind of already spoken about, one of her big things is really seeing a long-term vision for Oberlin and wanting to see Oberlin come out of the pandemic like a much stronger and more innovative school. So, you know, obviously there are all sorts of crazy stuff that we had to do this year because of COVID, like virtual classes and just like integrating technology into school in a way that we never had to do before. And so one of her things that she said she's been thinking about a lot this year is how can we take like what we've learned and keep the good parts of it, even when there's no more pandemic or even when the pandemic isn't as much of a concern. Especially because like this higher ed is going to get more and more competitive for colleges. She wants to see Oberlin be like this leader in higher ed rather than just another small liberal arts college. And so a lot of what I talked to her about is like, how do we, you know, best prepare students for their post-grad life? How do we like make sure we're communicating to the outside world? You know, how great we are. I think one of the things she said is like, are there areas where we're like not realizing as much success as we should? Like, we think we're really great in this area. Like, why don't other people see it that way? And spending time on like that sort of admissions communications angle. But a lot of, you know, one of the reasons I love talking to Ambar is because she's so kind of having this forward focused mindset and this innovative mindset. And I think a lot of her perspective on reconvening One Oberlin is hoping for these new programs. Like there's going to be a global health program and a business program. Like they're all concentrations. And just other ways that Oberlin can increase programs for students.
So going off of that, was there anything from your interviews that didn't make it into the article that you'd like to share?
Not really, honestly. I mean, I think we didn't go into as much depth about admissions, which we're kind of already talking about here, as I would have if it had been a longer piece or if we'd want to do a longer piece. You know, obviously in other pieces we've talked a lot about like how COVID has impacted planning for this year overall, and this idea of like you're going to try to take on this huge project, which is One Oberlin, in the midst of planning for a pandemic semester, a pandemic academic year. Like that is kind of the extra context that you might need to fully understand that. Other than like those extra little details, I don't think that there was anything super substantial that didn't make it into the article.
Well, then how do you see future coverage of One Oberlin? Because obviously this isn't going away.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think that as with the like news articles in general, it's very reactionary, right? So once new things are announced or once we hear of new things that are happening, we definitely will keep continuing to cover those new developments. In the coming, like in the next few weeks, the committee is actually going to reconvene and they will start figuring out, I think they're gathering data right now, whatever that means, on like what their next steps should be, basically. So I think it's still unclear to me which of these recommendations are going to be the highest priority and are going to be the thing that happens first. And so once we know, and once the committee starts to sort of implement these recommendations, we'll start, we'll keep kind of like covering that. And it's not that nothing's being implemented. Like, I know there's still some work happening with creating this business concentration. I know that like various like faculty and administrators are sort of planning what that concentration will look like and what they need to offer in order to give people a business education, which isn't a full major, but it is like still an academic, yeah, concentration. And so there's definitely stuff going on right now. And I hope to do actually a story about these concentrations pretty soon. But, you know, we'll just continue to cover whatever announcements happen and whatever we hear about.
Yeah. And now that you've covered topics like these and are learning more into what's going to happen, what are your thoughts on all of these developments recently?
You know, I think that One Oberlin in general was somewhat controversial among students because people felt that it was all about cutting programs and paying people less and, you know, being really kind of intense, or some people felt alarmist about this financial deficit. And like, I definitely, to some extent, this is my own opinion and not like the Oberlin Review's opinion, but to some extent, like, I hear that. At the same time, I think it's really important that Oberlin still exists in 20 years. Like, I think that it makes a lot of sense to want to get ahead of that. And so while I didn't always agree with the recommendations that they proposed, I don't necessarily have the full context to, or like the full context to say like what would have been a better way to reduce costs. Also, a lot of the report wasn't about reducing costs, and it was more about like creating these innovative programs. And I think it's really cool that during a moment where I guess the original goal or the primary goal was financial sustainability, they were also taking into account like academic preparation and new opportunities and the experience that we have as students, as OBs. So I would say I feel very mixed. And in general, I tried not to, in my reporting, focus too much on how I feel and more just let people decide what they feel, because I think it's a very nuanced issue. And I think if you don't treat it like that, then, well, no, I'll just leave it at that. It's a very nuanced issue.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. And I think it is important to remain objective, because that's mostly the aim of journalistic reporting in something like the Oberlin Review. But that's also why we wanted to ask you about this in your thoughts, because we can hear, I suppose.
Yeah.
Also, Anissa, you've spoken to a lot of like people in the administration about One Oberlin. Have you interviewed anyone recently from the broader Oberlin community in the town or anything like that?
Yeah, I got to talk to a student who was on the One Oberlin committee. I mean, I guess that's not a person from the town, but I one of the things that was important to me was that on this committee there were students representing, I guess, the student interests from pretty much the beginning. And so I talked to Kofi, who's a third year.
Right.
And it was interesting to me to hear like kind of his hopes for the more additive side of recommendations. Like, he was, as a pre-med student, pretty excited about like the global health concentration. I would love to continue to get student input. We oftentimes get like opinions pieces, op-eds from students about various like specific recommendations. So an example would be like, obviously when the college was outsourcing the unionized dining and custodial workers. I mean, you guys know this because you were in Oberlin during this time, but people were very upset about that, and students really came together and pushed back against that. And so we got a bunch of like op-eds about that. And I think that like for students, oftentimes they will have opinions about like very specific recommendations. And that's kind of the more interesting perspective for me from non-admin. But we always try to get not just the college's perspective, you know, like obviously we're a student newspaper first, and this is a college first. And yeah, I'm always interested to hear what students have to say. And they have a lot of things to say, you know?
Mm-hmm. All right, so we'd like to pivot a bit and talk more broadly about your work as the editor-in-chief of the Oberlin Review, but also, you know, you were previously the news editor. So, you know, this article that you wrote was part of the news section, and I see you're still writing for it. So what drew you to the news section?
Well, I was a first year when I started writing for the Review, so I was baby. But to me, like, the news section just seemed like it took me a long time to fully appreciate the other sections, like arts and sports and opinions. The news section is where all the juicy stuff happens, to me at least. Like, all of the controversy and all of the fast-paced stories generally tend to happen in the news section. And definitely that's not to say that the other sections aren't super important. In fact, you know, one of the problems with news writing is you have to be so, at least the way that the Review style works, is, you know, we tend to be very straightforward. And I think for some people that can feel restrictive in your writing. Like, in arts writing, you can sort of tell a story and have sort of flowery language. And we try to avoid too much kind of like flowery, silly language in the news section. So I think that, like, definitely that's where other sections really shine. But in content and who you get to talk to and the way people feel so passionately about, like, current issues, like, that's the fun part of news for me is, you know, when it's a Tuesday afternoon and some announcement drops and suddenly you have to email 5 people and throw together a story in a day. That doesn't happen as much in, like, sports. And it doesn't mean that it doesn't happen, but it doesn't happen as often. And so for me, like, news just felt like that's what gets you on the front page, you know? Like, I was a first year and I was like, yes, news, you know? And it's still like, that section still has, like, a special place in my heart because I, you know, I wrote for news and then I was news editor for a year and a half. But now that I edit the paper, I love all sections.
It does. Yeah. I was just thinking about how, like, in my first semester, I noticed there was, like, a nurse strike going on back in 2019. And I told Nathan about it, who was editor-in-chief at the time. And I remember him saying, like, can you cover this? I'm like, oh, wow. I'm brand new to the paper and I'm not used to the deadlines. Like, I have other stuff I need to be working on. And I was also working on, like, another piece that week. So I ended up contributing to the issue slightly through an ops piece. But I remember, like, I think either someone in the news section or one of the EICs, like, ended up covering it in like a day, like literally a day. And I was so blown away at how efficient the whole process was, but somehow they put it together.
Yeah, no, I think that's the crazy. And it can be really stressful because you're also a full-time student. But, like, that's also my favorite part about Oberlin is kind of like that stressful quality of fast-paced news, local, hyper-local journalism, you know?
Mm-hmm. And now that you are editor-in-chief, how has it been for your first year as EIC to be during the pandemic?
It's been interesting. Like, we changed a lot of sort of internal operations about the Review. We used to publish once a week in print. Now we publish twice a week only online because the college said they didn't want print issues of any publication, because that's a lot of, like, touching between different people. So just that process has been very different, like, you know, and this kind of gets into the nitty gritty of how you run a newspaper. I don't know how interesting that is to outsiders. But we have a production process where every single story gets read by, I think, 12 different people. People read it for fact checking and for our style guide, and for grammar, and then editor-in-chief will read it for, well, then the editor of the section that it's in, so, like, the sports editor or the arts editor, will read it, and then one editor-in-chief will read it for content and change, like, things that help with flow or clarity, and then someone else will read it for grammar again, and someone else will read it for content, and then the other editor-in-chief will do a final read. So it's kind of like this really long process in the evening. And so now we're doing that twice a week on Tuesday and Thursday, rather than it was kind of more concentrated because we were only publishing once a week. So that's definitely been different. And also when I was news editor, there were weeks when we were like, oh gosh, we really have to pull together. Like, we have to think of something to cover. Like, nothing's happening. We live in this tiny town in Ohio. We go to this small school and we have to like make a little feature or like come up with something sort of fun to cover because there's no like fast events. And the news editors this year have not had that experience, I don't think, pretty much at all. Like, every single week, somehow, even though there's like fewer events, like, and every single week there's something to cover, and every single week there's several things. There's enough things to fill the section. That being said, for arts and sports, they've had the opposite problem. There's fewer, like, you know, events to cover. There's no competitions. So they've had to get really creative. And we've had to try to, you know, Catherine and I, who's the other editor in chief, have had to get really creative in like coming up with, I don't know, creative ways to cover the art that's still happening on this campus and the athletics that are still happening on this campus, even though they're not happening to the same capacity and in the same way that they were pre-pandemic. But I think that that's been a big change, is being online and then also just the types of stories that we're able to cover based on what's happening.
Mm-hmm. So what has been happening? Like, is most of your coverage just COVID related?
We're trying to not have every single thing be COVID related. A lot of things are touched by COVID, but, you know, there was this sort of structure of story that we were doing a lot at the beginning of the pandemic that was like, here's this thing that already existed and here is how it's being affected by COVID, but people are still resilient, and you end on that. And we were like, we can't keep doing this story. Like, it was like, you know, we're talking about small businesses, or we're talking about like the theater department, or we're talking about like seniors who have capstones, like anything. And we kept writing like a very similar story because it kept being true. But we were like, okay, come on. Like, we're going to write some other stories too. So I think we've, especially this semester, been trying to focus on things that aren't COVID related when possible. But it's kind of like everything is touched by COVID in some way, you know? At least I feel like that. I feel like that in my everyday life, not my review life, but just my life as a student. It's like everything's touched by COVID.
Mm-hmm. So now that, I don't know if you guys are still meeting or anything, but I imagine like it's much less decentralized. I mean, it's much more decentralized than it used to be.
Yeah. So last semester, a lot of people were off campus. We had a lot of juniors working for us. And it was a little, you know, one of the great things about the review is the community, and like you automatically have this group of like, you know, 20 to 30 people who you work with and you spend a lot of time with. And we were not really encouraging like an in-person component that much last semester. This semester, almost, with the exception of like two people, almost everyone's on campus. And so we've been able to like be, you know, we have a socially distanced office in Wilder, which is not our normal office that we love, but at least it is a space where we can be together and sort of goof off while we work. And it has like finally had that like sense of community that I really missed. But definitely like trying to communicate when we're not always meeting in person, and trying to communicate with people who are, you know, not enrolled in school and are living somewhere else, like that was a big thing that we had to figure out, and a little bit of a hurdle. Yeah.
Before we get to our last question, this is kind of off topic, but you're a veteran of the weekly. How does it feel to be back for season 4?
I'm so happy that I feel like you guys have been doing such a good job, and doing a thing that I don't feel like I have the bandwidth to do, which is like actually producing really good and edited content, which is always like what I wanted the weekly to be. And some weeks it was able to be that, and other people, you know, what, like there was other people who were doing the weekly who were able to do that. But I'm so excited that you guys are doing this, and it's so fun to be interviewed. I interview people all the time, but I've never interviewed. It's kind of weird.
Well, we were really happy to have you on.
I'm so happy to be talking to you guys.
So to wrap up, we just wanted to ask you if there was anything else you'd like to add.
The classic review end question. I tell everyone to I'm teaching an EXCO this year about student journalism, sort of to get more student writers and stuff. And this week we were talking, like literally yesterday I had a class and Catherine and I were like, and you always have to end the interview with, is there anything else you want to add? As for that question, I don't think that there really is. I think we covered pretty much everything. I'm really excited to keep covering One Oberlin and seeing the ways that it impacts our college. I think there's a lot of things in flux in higher ed in general, and I, for the most part, feel very excited about the way that Oberlin is handling that and meeting that head on, kind of.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Nisa, thank you so much again for taking the time to speak with us. We really appreciate you just breaking down One Oberlin for all our listeners, and we look forward to hearing more from you.
Thank you so much for chatting with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're listening to WOBC Oberlin 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. This has been The Weekly. Thank you for listening.